I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. All this week, the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures, The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, by Wade Davis. The CBC Massey Lectures began in 1961, and over the years, these broadcasts have become a place where the best minds of our time discuss the issues that face us, both as Canadians and as citizens of the world. The three partners in this great enterprise are CBC Radio, Massey College and the University of Toronto, and House of Anansi Press, publisher of the book of the lectures. In earlier years, the Masseys were recorded in a radio studio. But 7 years ago, we took the lectures out of the studio and onto the road. So the lectures you're hearing this week were all recorded in front of a live audience, this year in Yellowknife, Vancouver, Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto. The 2009 CBC Massey lecturer is anthropologist, filmmaker, and writer Wade Davis, whose curiosity and researches have ranged from zombies in Haiti to sacred plants in South America. Among many books, he's the author of The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was made into a movie, and One River, nominated for the Governor General's Award. There is no beginning and end in Barasana thought, says Wade Davis. No sense of a linear progression of time, destiny, or fate. A rapid is an impediment to travel, but also a house of the ancestors, with both a front and a back door. A stool is not a symbol of a mountain. It is in every sense an actual mountain, upon the summit of which sits the shaman. The infinite elements of the Barasana world spin like a carousel in the mind. From the Rebecca Cohn Auditorium in Halifax, here's Wade Davis with Peoples of the Anaconda, the third of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
Let's begin this third of the Massey Lectures with a story from the shadowy days of the Spanish conquest. In February 1541, Gonzalo Pizarro, half-brother of Francisco, the conqueror of the Inca, began a journey across the Andes in search of El Dorado and the fabled lands of canela, of cinnamon and gold. Leaving Quito with 220 soldiers, 4,000 native porters, and 2,000 pigs for food, the expedition crested the heights of the Cordillera and began a long, slow descent through the tangled lianas and stunted trees of the cloud forest. By the time it reached the tropical lowlands, where the riverbanks gleamed by night with black caiman, the hogs and horses had long since been consumed, and most of the Indian slaves had perished, as had 140 Spaniards. The surviving men, reduced to stewing leather and herbs, scavenged for roots and berries that left several of them deranged by poison. In desperation, Gonzalo dispatched his second in command, Francisco de Orellana, along with 49 men, down a high jungle tributary in search of provisions and deliverance. Among this group was a white-frocked Dominican friar, Gaspar de Carvajal, who wrote an astonishing account of the subsequent journey. Reaching the Napo, one of more than 1,000 major rivers that drain the Amazon, the men led by Orellana mutinied, refusing in their agony to return upstream as per the original orders. The current was too powerful, and at any rate, no food had been found. Orellana, in a kind of fit of legal formality for which the conquistadors were famous, officially resigned his commission with Gaspar de Carvajal as his witness, that he might accept by acclamation a new command at the head of the bedraggled survivors. Abandoning Gonzalo Pizarro to his fate, Orellana and his band set off into the unknown one day after Christmas, 1541. Heading down the swift-flowing Napo, on a launch hastily crafted from jungle trees and iron nails scavenged from the hooves of dead horses. Tormented by the sun and haunted at night by the roar of howlers, the low hallucinatory drone of frogs and cicadas, the unexpected bark of jaguars, they reached after several days the confluence of the Napo with the Rio Ucayali, as the Amazon is known in Peru. There, to their horror, they found the shores lined with Indian settlements, each linked to the next by the sound of messenger drums that guaranteed a hostile reception at every bend of the river. Three Spaniards died, targets of the flying death, darts coated in curare and shot silently from the forest. Gaspar de Cabrajal was himself blinded in one eye by an arrow, which, fortunately for history, was not poisonous. His journal records the anguish of men festering with disease, their lethargic bodies riddled with parasites, their guts wrenching from lack of food. It was cruel torment indeed, for with each passing kilometer, the richness and prosperity of the native villages only increased, along with the bounty of the fields, the physical beauty and numbers of the inhabitants, and the evident elaboration of high culture. After 9 days and several hundred kilometers, the Spaniards entered the land of the Omagua and found, to their utter astonishment, a continuous series of villages, some stretching some 300 kilometers along the shores, each no more, as Cavajal reported, than a crossbow shot apart. One community stretched for 5 leagues, roughly 25 kilometers, a single concentration of thatch-roofed houses. After 6 months, Orellana's group passed the confluence of the Rio Negro, a tributary that, were to exist on any other continent, would be the second largest river on Earth. The scale of forest, river, and sky utterly unsettled their senses. On the banks of the Rio Namunda, 2 days further downstream, they met Indians who claimed to be the vassals of a ferocious tribe of female warriors, outliers of a civilization of women who dwelt in the distant headwaters in villages of stone at the edge of saltwater lakes. There, these women were said to ride camels. They wore the finest of woven cloth and worshipped the divinity of the sun in temples lined with macaw feathers and parrot plumes. To procreate, they captured men solely for the purpose of breeding. All male offspring were summarily killed. A fortnight later, according to Carabajal, the expedition literally entered the land of the Amazons and actually encountered and did battle with squadrons of Indians led by female captains, naked women, tall and white, with long braided hair wound about the head. Each fought, it was said, with a power of 10 men, and it was only after several had been killed by the Spaniards, their brigandine riddled with arrows, that they managed to escape. The further they drifted downstream, the more elaborate became the settlements. At the mouth of the Rio Tapajós, near the modern Brazilian town of Santarém, the expedition was met by a flotilla of 200 war canoes, each carrying 30 men, all in full regalia, with brilliant cloaks of feathers and coronas that shone like the sun. Tens of thousands of more Indians, men, women, and children, stood warily along the shore. The riverbanks for hundreds of kilometers were dense with houses and gardens, and away from the shore there were signs, Carabajal reported, of very large cities. When finally, on August 24, 1542, 8 months after setting out on the Rio Napo, and fully a year and a half since the expedition had left the cool mountain air of Quito, Orellana's naked band, too weakened to row, reached salvation and the sea. Still, they remained confounded by the wonder of a river that had brought them there. The Amazon, at the time of European contact, was no empty forest, but an artery of civilization and home to hundreds of thousands, indeed millions, of human beings. By the time anthropologists entered the Amazon in numbers in the 1950s, the main trunk of the river and the lower reaches of its principal tributaries had been settled by Europeans for more than 400 years. Indeed, a unique world had emerged, a kind of riverine peasantry of caboclos, men and women of mixed heritage whose entire subsistence base was in fact derived from indigenous antecedents and adaptations. But of the original inhabitants of the floodplain of the Amazon, there existed only shadows in the sand, whispered messages in the forest. The Andes, a formidable barrier, were not traversed from the west by roads until after the Second World War. Many of these cultures did not experience sustained contact until the 1960s. The Warani, for example, with whom I lived with in the late 1970s and early 1980s, were not peacefully contacted until 1958, though their homeland is scarcely 150 kilometers from Quito, the national capital of Ecuador, and a city settled for well over 400 years. Now, the Warani were and are an exceptional people, and their history in many ways is unique. But at the same time, they fit a basic pattern shared by many of these marginal societies, marginal only in the sense that they lived literally at the margins of the Amazon basin. These cultures were, for the most part, small in numbers, without hierarchy or intense specialization. They tended to be acephalous, lacking overt political leaders, and perhaps most characteristically, they were endogenous. They married amongst themselves, living in isolation and often in open conflict with their neighbors. They had, of course, extraordinary gifts. I remember Warani hunters could smell animal urine at 40 paces in the rainforest and tell you what species of life had left that urine behind. And, of course, as a botanist, I witnessed dazzling examples of pharmacological wizardry, and through generations of empirical observation and experimentation, the people of the forest had learned to manipulate plants with extraordinary skill. And, as we learned in school and as we witnessed in the forest, in making a living from the Amazon, they had found a way, through the technology of slash-and-burn agriculture, to grow food despite the nutrient-poor soils. Small plots cut from the forest were fired and burned, planted and harvested with ever-diminishing returns for perhaps 3 years, and then abandoned to be reclaimed by the forest. Now, as we learned, all of this activity was critically dependent on population density. Too many people would result in too many fields, with no time for the vegetation to regenerate, the exhaustion of the land, and the saturation of the carrying capacity of the environment. Now, I'm sure many of you in school learned that basic scenario in terms of the Amazon. And to a remarkable extent, this very cultural scenario became the filter through which anthropologists understood indigenous life in the Amazon. Societies, it was implied, clung precariously to a perilous existence, constrained always by the environment and its limitations. But beginning in the 1980s, remarkable new techniques unveiled utterly unexpected worlds. Working on the island of Marajó in the Delta, archaeologist Anna Roosevelt in particular found evidence of an astonishing complex civilization, perhaps as many as 100,000 people spread over thousands of square kilometers that had persisted for at least 1,000 years. Upriver, in the epicenter of the basin near the city of Manaus, at the confluence of the Rio Negro, massive earthen burial mounds were discovered, dating to roughly 1,000 years ago, providing evidence that whoever had occupied the land had exploited and grown some 138 domesticated plants, most of which were fruit trees and palms. Botanists and ecologists, meanwhile, were discovering throughout the Amazon these very strange and curious anomalies. Large but isolated expanses of terra preta, black soil, clearly of human origins, showing that people had in fact stayed put and actively worked to enhance the agricultural potential of the land with charcoal for nutrient retention, organic waste as compost. Anthropologists today recognize that our understanding of these ancient worlds has been for too long filtered through our experience with the marginal societies that survived what was in fact a Holocaust. To understand the prehistory of the Amazon basin through this lens is rather like attempting to reconstruct the history of the British Empire from the perspective of the Hebrides after London has been wiped out by a nuclear bomb. Within a century of contact, disease and slavery had swept away millions of indigenous lives. And yet, incredibly, there is one place in the Amazon where the rhythm of these great civilizations may still be felt and heard, the homeland of an extraordinary complex of cultures known collectively as the peoples of the Anaconda. In 1975, when I first traveled to the northwest Amazon of Colombia, I stopped en route in a small town of Villavicencio, nestled into the eastern foothills of the Andes. I wanted to visit a legendary naturalist, Frederico Medem, a Latvian count who had fled the Russian Revolution and forged a new life in the forests of the lowland tropics. I remember always encountering Dr. Medem. I found him in the evening at his home, a rambling compound that resembled the quarters of an old rubber trader. The house had wooden floors and a tin roof, an open veranda hung with hammocks, and walls decorated with jaguar and bushmaster skins. Overhead in his office, a ceiling fan cast faint shadows across the desk as he caressed an artifact or ran his fingers over a fading map drawn by hand a century before. His most prized possession was a shaman's necklace, a single strand of palm fiber threaded through a 6-inch crystal of quartz. He described it as both the penis and the crystallized semen of Father Sun, explaining that within it were 30 different colors, all distinct energies that had to be balanced in sacred ritual. The necklace was also the shaman's house, the place to which he went when he took yahe, the hallucinogenic preparation, also known to many of you as ayahuasca, the vine of the soul. Once inside, the shaman looks out at the world over the territory of his people and the sacred sites, the forests, waterfalls, mountain escarpments, and blackwater rivers, watching and watching the ways of the animals. Long after Medem had retired for the night, I remained in his office reading a book that he had recommended, Amazonian Cosmos, written by his good friend Geraldo Reichel-Domatoff, Colombia's foremost anthropologist. It was from Reichel that I first learned of the importance of rivers. For the Indians of the Vaupés, rivers are not just routes of communication. They are the veins of the earth, the link between the living and the dead, the paths along which the ancestors traveled at the beginning of time. The origin myths vary, but they always speak of a great journey from the east, of sacred canoes brought up the Milk River from the east by enormous anaconda. Within the canoes were the first people, together with the three most important plants, coca, manioc, and yahe, gifts of Father Sun. On the heads of the anaconda were blinding lights, and in the canoes sat mythical heroes in hierarchical order, chiefs, wisdom keepers who were the dancers and chanters, warriors, shaman, and finally in the tale, servants. All were brothers, children of the sun. When the serpents reached the center of the world, they lay over the land outstretched as rivers, their powerful heads forming river mouths, their tails winding away to the remote headwaters, the ripples in their skin giving rise to rapids and waterfalls. Each river welcomed a different canoe, and in each drainage, the five archetypal heroes disembarked and settled, with the lowly servants heading upstream and the chiefs occupying the mouth. Thus, the rivers of the Vaupés were created and populated, with the Desana people coming into being on the Rio Papori, the Barasana and Tatuyos on the Upper Paraná, the Tucano on the Vaupés, Macuna on the Popayacu and the Lower Paraná, and the Tanimucas and Letuanas on the Miriti and Apaporas. In time, the hierarchy described in the myths broke down, and on each of the rivers, the descendants of those who had journeyed in the same sacred canoe came to live together. They recognized each other as family, speakers of the same language. And to ensure that no brother married a sister, they invented strict rules. To avoid incest, a man had to choose a bride who spoke a different language. So today, when a young woman marries in the Vaupés, she moves to the longhouse of her husband. Their children will be raised in the language of the father, but naturally will learn the language of the mother. The mother, meanwhile, will be working with the children's aunts, the wives of their father's brothers. But each of these women may come from a different linguistic group. In a single settlement, therefore, as many as a dozen languages may be spoken, and it is quite common for an individual to be fluent in as many as five. Yet, curiously and amazingly, one never hears a child practicing a new tongue, a distinct language. They simply wait, watch, listen, and one day begin to speak fluently. Thus, the importance, or at least one of the most important consequences of this marriage rule, what anthropologists call linguistic exogamy, is a certain tension that inevitably comes into the lives of the people. With the quest for potential marriage partners ongoing and the distances between neighboring language groups considerable, cultural mechanisms must ensure that eligible young men and women come together on a regular basis. Thus, the importance, Reichel Domatoff wrote, of the gatherings and great festivals that mark the cycles of the year. Through sacred dance, the recitation of myth, and the sharing of coca and yahe, these celebrations promote the spirit of reciprocity and exchange on which the entire social system depends, even as they link, through ritual, the living with their mythical ancestors and the beginning of time. Well, this all came to me in one evening from a single book. Intrigued by what I had read, I arranged passage the very next morning on a military cargo flight to meet two, a small settlement without road access, perched on a bend of the Rio Vaupés, 3 hours by air from Villa Vicencio. I remember there was no door on the old decrepit DC-3, and I felt like I was riding the back of a pickup truck through the sky. I spent the better part of a month that season in Mitú, botanizing with the local Indians, Cubeos and Tucanos for the most part, but I never came close to the heart of their world, spiritually, culturally, or literally. The forests were so vast, forests the size of France. The distance is too great. The rivers black and stunningly beautiful, but broken by an endless succession of cataracts and waterfalls. 2 years later, I returned and I persuaded the missionary pilot to drop me at the Catholic mission of San Miguel on the Rio Piraparaná in the homeland of the Barasana, an hour further into the forest from Mitú. It was about as remote a destination as one could devise in the northwest Amazon. But this, too, was a fleeting visit, and barriers of language and protocol, I mean, I quite literally dropped in from the sky unannounced, left me with only a superficial sense of the place and a very sad feeling in that spring of 1975 that with the influence of the missionaries, an extraordinary culture was destined to be lost. This, of course, was the familiar lament of anthropologists of that day. Wherever we went, we encountered what we assumed to be disappearing worlds. But then, long after my first fumbling visits to the Northwest Amazon, something truly remarkable occurred. In 1986, newly elected Colombian president Virgilio Barco appointed a man called Martin von Hildebrand, an anthropologist and protege of Reichel Domatoff, as head of indigenous affairs. And he told Martin to do something for the Indian peoples of Colombia. Martin, who had lived for years among the Tanimucos and first paddled the length of the Piraparaná as a young graduate student, did more than something. In 5 extraordinary years, he secured for the Indians of the Colombian Amazon legal land rights to an area of some 250,000 square kilometers, roughly the size of the United Kingdom, titled lands that were encoded by law in the 1991 political constitution of the country. Nothing like this had ever been done by a nation state. In the years that followed, as Colombia endured the ravages of war throughout the 1990s and the early days of this new century, a veil of isolation fell upon the Northwest Amazon. And behind this veil, as Martin explained when he first invited me in 2006 to return with him to the Rio Piraparaná, an extraordinary and ancient dream of the earth was reborn. The night before flying out of Me Too, Martin and I huddled on the cement floor of our modest lodgings, taking coca and tobacco, as Ricardo Marin, a Barasana shaman, identified on a large map the sacred sites we were about to see from the air and visit by river and trail. In Barasana, there is no word for time, and the sacred sites are not memorials or symbols of distant mythic events. They are living places, as Ricardo explained, that eternally inform the present. For his people, the past is the present, and the sacred sites are to this day inhabited by mythic beings. The following morning, our small plane rose into the clouds and then burst over the canopy like a wasp, minuscule and insignificant. The forest stretched to the horizon, with little initially to betray that people had ever set foot on the land. Ricardo, the shaman, sat in front of me, and I watched him intently as he took in the vista, wanting to see what he saw. We flew that morning for 4 hours, circumnavigating the entire world of the peoples of the Anaconda, heading east from Me Too over the Rio Papari, and then south along the ancient ridges that separate Colombia from Brazil. Reaching the confluence of the Rio Caquetá and the Apaporis, we turned west over the great cataracts of Yuisi and Hirihirimo to the mouth of the Cananari, which we followed north across sandstone escarpments that predate the birth of the Andes. To the west, I could see the distant silhouette of Cerro Campana, small on the horizon, and the immense flat-top ridges of Chiribiquete, uplifted tablelands, massive and impossibly remote. Clouds swept over the canopy, and at one point a perfect rainbow arched across the sky, touching the forest on both sides of the Rio Apaporis, which flowed beneath it like a serpent through a silent and unchanging forest. We landed late in the day at the dirt airstrip of San Miguel, the very Catholic mission I had visited in 1977. I recognized the fields, the setting of the great longhouse of the Maloca, and the white sands along the river where children and women bathed in the black waters of the Piraparaná. But otherwise, everything seemed very different indeed. A mission I recalled as a rather sad place of desuetude was gone. On our very first night, 100 or more men gathered in the Maloca in feather regalia to dance, chant, and take sacred medicines, coca and tobacco, chicha and yahe. Shaman huddled over calabashes of spirit food, whispering and softly singing spells. For the very first time in my life, I heard the haunting sound of the sacred Urapari trumpets created by the ancestors at the dawn of time. Long condemned by Catholic priests as symbols of the devil, these mythic instruments had been crushed and burned during the years of the mission. That their sound was still here, inspiring new generations of Barasana, Makuna, Tatuyos, and other peoples of the river, suggested powerfully that the culture was very much alive. In the 30 years or more since my first visit, the only thing that had disappeared on the Rio Piraparaná, as Martin said, were the bloody missionaries. Over the course of nearly a month, guided by Martin and Ricardo and other Barasana and Makuna leaders, such as Maximiliano Garcia and Renel Ortega, we traveled the rivers, attended ceremonies, and visited sacred sites, cataracts where culture heroes had done battle with the forces of darkness and brought order into the world, domes of black stone that held up the sky, waterfalls that ran red with the menstrual blood of Romikumu, the great mother and progenitor of the earth.
You
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius Satellite Radio 137 across North America and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. The people of the tropical rainforest, argues Wade Davis, have supremely adapted to their difficult landscape. They've learned to read the natural world like words in a book. From the Rebecca Cohn Auditorium in Halifax, Peoples of the Anaconda, the third of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
There is no beginning or end in Bodhisattva thought, no sense of a linear progression of time, destiny, or fate. Theirs is a fractal world in which no event has a life of its own, and any number of ideas can coexist in parallel levels of perception and meaning. Scale succumbs to intention. Every single object must be understood at various levels of analysis. A rapid is an impediment to travel, but also a house of the ancestors, with both a front and a back door. A stool is not a symbol of a mountain. It is in every sense an actual mountain, upon the summit of which sits the shaman. A row of stools is the ancestral anaconda, and the patterns painted onto the wood of the stools depict both the journey of the ancestors and the striations that literally decorate the serpent's skin. A corona of Oropendila feathers really is the sun, each yellow plume a ray. The infinite elements of the Bodhisattva world spin like a carousel in the mind, and there is no one obvious point of departure for even a modest attempt to explain the profundity of the people's intuitions about the meaning of being alive, save perhaps the maloka, the longhouse, which is both a physical space in which the people live and a cosmic model of the entire universe. If civilizations are to be measured, however crudely, by the scale of their monumental architecture, just as we measure the stonework of the Inca, the temples of the Maya, then the maloka is proof of the stunning achievements of the ancient peoples of the Amazon. These structures, these longhouses, are enormous, their internal dimensions all-encompassing, 40 meters in length, perhaps 20 abreast, with vaulted ceilings rising to 10 meters above a dirt floor hardened by 10,000 thunderous dance steps, as well as a quiet passage of children at dawn. The maloka is the womb of the kindred, the dark and cool shelter of the clan, the communal space in which occurs and out of which emerges every societal gesture of the spirit. The symmetry of the structures is exquisite. 8 vertical posts spaced evenly in 2 rows, with 2 smaller pairs near the doors, front and back, crossbeams and pleated rows of thatch woven over a grid of rafters. The house posts are named for the clan ancestors. The painted designs on the front facade depict the spirit beings and the patterns of color and visions unleashed in the mind by Yahe, the sacred preparation. On a mundane level, the space is divided between the genders, with the front of the longhouse being reserved for visitors and men. This is the social axis, the place where, in the flare of resonant beeswax torches, coca is prepared at night, and tobacco taken in such concentrations that sweat comes to the fingertips and the world spins wildly, yet always in harmonic resonance. The women control the opposite end of the space, where the clay griddle rests on the 4 corner posts of the world, and cassava, a deadly poisonous plant, is each day transformed by the mothers into food, the daily bread of the people. The sustenance emerges at one stage in its preparation from a carefully woven sieve that is itself the mouth of the anaconda. The roof of the maloka is the sky, the house posts, the stone pillars and mountains that support it. The mountains, in turn, are the petrified remains of ancestral beings, the culture heroes who created the world. The smaller post represents the descendants of the original serpent. The ridgepole is simultaneously the path of the sun, the river of the sky, the Milky Way, and the artery that separates the living from the limits of the universe. The floor, by contrast, is the earth, and beneath it runs the river of the underworld, the stream of death and sorrow. Thus, a celestial river crosses the sky even as its inverse, a path of death, traverses the underworld. Each day, the sun travels the sky from east to west, and each night, it returns from west to east, following the river of the underworld, which is the place of the dead. The Barasana bury their elders in the floor of the Maloka, in coffins made of broken canoes. As they go about their daily lives, living within a space literally perceived as the womb of their lineage, the Indians walk above the physical remains of their ancestors. And yet, inevitably, the spirits of the dead drift away. And to facilitate their departure, the Maloka is always built close to water. And since all rivers, including the river of the underworld, are believed to run east, each Maloka must be oriented on an east-west axis, with a door at each end, one for the men and one for the women. Thus, the placement of the Malokas adjacent to running streams is not just a matter of convenience. It is a deliberate way of acknowledging the cycle of life and death. The water both recalls the primordial act of creation, the river journey of the anaconda and the mythical heroes, even as it foreshadows the inevitable moment of decay and rebirth. Now, if the longhouse in which people live envelops a community, securing its kind of eternal presence, celebrating its mythical origins, the earth itself is protected by a universal Maloka that hovers over the land, anchored by the sacred sites. The world of the Barasana and their neighbors is conceived as being flat and round as the clay griddle the women use to make manioc bread. As clay blocks prop up the griddle, so the actual sky of the world, the roof of the cosmic Maloka, is supported by a distant ring of hills through which pass four sacred gateways. The doors of the north and the south are the rib doors that link the body of humanity to the cosmos. The gateway to the west is the door of suffering, the destiny of the dead, and the axis through which destructive forces enter and stain the world. The water door to the east leads to the mouth of the Milk River, the point of origin where earth fuses with sky and the sun is born. For the Barasana and Makuna, these gateways are actual places, and traveling with Ricardo Marin, we actually saw them from the sky. The world begins at the falls of Yuisi and ends at the cataracts of Hirihirimo on the Apaporis. The hills along the Brazilian frontier and the falls of Yuripari on the Rio Valpez and the Arauacuara on the Rio Caquetá, these mountain escarpments that reach beyond the sandstone massifs of Canari, these are all physical points of origins, a mythic geography consciously written upon the land. In the beginning, according to Barasana ideas, before the creation of seasons, before the ancestral mother, Romikumu, woman shaman, opened her womb, before her blood and breast milk gave rise to rivers and her ribs to the mountain ridges of the world, there was only chaos in the universe. Spirits and demons known as hei preyed upon their own kindred, bred without thought, committed incest without consequence, devoured their own young. Romikumu responded by destroying the world with fire and floods. Then, just as a mother turns over a warm slab of manioc bread on the griddle, she turned the inundated and charred world upside down, creating a flat and empty template from which life could emerge once again. As woman shaman, she then gave birth to a new world, land, water, forest, animals. In a parallel story of creation, four great culture heroes, the Iowa, the primordial ancestors, the thunders as they're known, came up the Milk River from the east, passing through the water door, pushing before them as plows the sacred trumpets of the Yuripari, creating all valleys and waterfalls. Rivers were born from their saliva. Slivers of wood broken off by their efforts gave rise to the first ritual artifacts and musical instruments. As the Iowa journeyed toward the center of the world, the notes of the trumpets themselves brought into being the cosmic Maloka, the mountains and the uplands, the posts and walls of the world. At every turn, the Iowa confronted greedy demonic forces, avaricious species that thrived on destruction and coveted the world. Outwitting these monsters, casting them into stone, the Iowa brought order to the universe, causing the essence and energy of the natural world to be released for the benefit of all sentient creatures and every form of life. Then, stealing the creative fire from the vagina of Romikumu, woman shaman, they made love to her, and fully satiated, they rose into the heavens to become thunder and lightning. Realizing that she was pregnant, woman shaman went downriver to the water door of the east, where she gave birth to the ancestral anaconda. In time, the serpent retraced the harrowing journey of the Iowa, returning in body and spirit to the riverbanks, waterfalls, and rocks, where it birthed the clan ancestors of the Barasana, Makuna, and all their neighbors. Each of these physical and geographical points of memory remains to this day vibrant and alive, the sacred nexus where the Iowa released to humans the raw energy of life, even as they bequeathed to all peoples of the Anaconda the eternal obligation to manage the flow of creation. Thus, for the people living in the forests of the Pitaparana, the entire natural world is saturated with meaning and cosmological significance. Every rock and waterfall embodies a story. Plants and animals are but distinct physical manifestations of the same essential spiritual essence. At the same time, everything is more than it appears, for the visible world is only one level of perception. Behind every tangible form, every plant and animal is a shadow dimension, a place invisible to ordinary people, but visible to the shaman. This is the realm of the Hay spirits, a world of deified ancestors where rocks and rivers are alive, plants and animals are human beings, sap and blood, the bodily fluids of the primordial river of the Anaconda. Hidden in cataracts, behind the physical veil of waterfalls, in the very center of stones, are the great malokas of the Hay spirits, where everything is beautiful. The shining feathers, the coca, the calabash of tobacco powder, which is itself the skull and brain of the sun. It is to the realm of the Hay spirits that the shaman goes in ritual. Contrary to popular lore in the West, the shaman of the Barasana never use or manipulate medicinal plants. His duty and sacred task is to move in the timeless realm of the Hay spirits, embracing the primordial powers and harnessing and restoring the energy of all creation. He is like a modern engineer who enters the depths of a nuclear reactor to renew the entire cosmic order. Among the Barasana, such renewal is the fundamental obligation of the living. In practice, this implies that the Barasana see the earth as potent, the forest as being alive with spiritual beings and ancestral powers. To live off the land is to embrace both its creative and its destructive potential. Human beings, plants, and animals share the same cosmic origins, and in a profound sense are seen as essentially identical, responsive to the same principles, obligated by the same duties, responsible for the collective well-being of all creation. So there is no separation between nature and culture. Without the forest and the rivers, humans would perish. But without people, the natural world would have no order or meaning. All would be chaos. Thus, the norms that drive social behavior also define the manner in which human beings interact with the wild, the plants and the animals, the multiple phenomena of the natural world, lightning and thunder, the sun and the moon, the scent of a blossom, the sour odor of death. Everything is related, everything connected, a single integrated whole. Mythology infuses land and life with meaning, encoding expectations and behaviors essential to survival in the forest, anchoring each community, every maloca, to a profound spirit of place. Now, these cosmological ideas, which may seem so baroque and even mysterious, have very real ecological consequences, both in terms of the way people live and the impacts they have on their environment. The forest is the realm of the men, the garden the domain of women, where they give birth to both plants and children. The women cultivate 30 or more food crops and encourage the fertility and fecundity of some 20 varieties of wild fruits and nuts. The men grow only tobacco and coca, which they plant in narrow, winding paths that run through the women's fields like serpents in the grass. For the women, the act of harvesting and preparing cassava, the daily bread, is a gesture of procreation and a form of initiation. The starchy fluid left over once the grated mash has been fully rinsed is seen as female blood that can be rendered safe by heat and drunk warm like a mother's milk. The crude manioc fiber resembles the bone of men. Fired on the griddle, shaped by female hands, the cassava is the medium through which the plant spirits of the wild are domesticated for the good of all. Like all food, it has an ambivalent potential. It gives life, but can also bring disease and misfortune. Thus, nothing can be eaten in the Barasana culture unless it is passed through the hands of an elder, being blessed and spiritually cleansed by the shaman. For the Barasana, food, in this sense, is power, for it represents a transfer of energy from one life form to another. As a child grows, he or she is only slowly introduced to new categories of food, and severe food restrictions mark all major passages of life, moments of initiation for a male, the first menses for a girl, transitional moments when the human being by definition is in contact with the spirit realm of the hay. When men go to the forest to hunt or fish, it is never a trivial passage. First, the shaman must travel in trance to negotiate with the masters of the animals, forging a mystical contract with the spirit guardians and exchanged based always on reciprocity. The Barasana compare it to a marriage, for hunting too is a form of courtship in which one seeks the blessing of a greater authority for the honor of taking into one's family a precious being. Meat is not the right of a hunter, but a gift from the spirit world. To kill without permission is to risk death by a spirit guardian, be it in the form of a jaguar, anaconda, tapir, or harpy eagle. Man in the forest is always both predator and prey. The same cautious and established social protocols that maintain peace and respect between neighboring clans of people, that facilitate the exchange of ritual goods, food, and women, are applied to the natural world, to the forest. All animals are potential kin, just as the wild rivers and forests are part of the social world of people. Since virtually every bend and rapid in a river, every stream crossing and every stone is associated with a mythic event, the entire landscape is mapped in the mind of the shaman. Hunters avoid salt licks. Fishing is prohibited in places toxic with the blood of the ancestors, beaches and side channels that also happen to be the spawning habitat of the river fishes. Entire stretches of the river Pitaparana, home to several hundreds of species of fish, are deemed off-limits for spiritual reasons. Shamanic sanctions, though inspired by cosmology, have the very real effect of mitigating the impact of human beings on the environment. And as the mythological events that inspired such beliefs are ongoing, the consequence and outcome is a living, dynamic philosophy that really does view man and nature as one. White people, Ricardo told me, see with their eyes, but the Barasana see with their minds. They journey both to the dawn of time and into the future, visiting every sacred site, paying homage to every creature, as they celebrate their most profound cultural insight, the realization that animals and plants are only people in another dimension of reality. This is the essence of the Bhadasana philosophy. Consider for a moment what this implies and what it tells us about the culture and its place in history. It is a tradition based on knowledge acquired through time and intense priestly study and initiation. Status accrues to the man of wisdom, not to the warrior. There are Maloka's rival in grandeur, the great architectural creations of humanity. They have a complex understanding of astronomy, solar calendars, intensely complex notions of hierarchy and specialization. Their wealth is vested in ritual regalia as elegant as that of a medieval court. Their systems of exchange, infinitely complex, facilitate peace, not war. Their struggle to bring order to the universe, to maintain the energetic flows of life, and the specificity of their beliefs and adaptations leave open the very remarkable possibility that the Bhadasana are the survivors of a world that once existed. The complex societies, chieftains, and civilizations that so astonished Caspar de Cabrajal and Francisco de Orellana, the lost civilizations of the Amazon. Perhaps in the adaptation and cultural survival of the Bhadasana and Makuna and all the peoples of the Anaconda, we can glimpse something of the beliefs and convictions that once allowed untold millions of people to live along the banks of the world's greatest river. When the Bhadasana today engage in ritual and take yahe, this astonishing preparation, and say that they travel through multiple dimensions, reliving the journey of the Iowa, alighting on the sacred sites, accomplishing all of these remarkable spiritual deeds, it is because they really do. When we say that the Bhadasana and their neighbors both echo the ancient pre-Columbian past and point a way forward, embodying a model by which human societies can actually live and thrive in the Amazon basin without laying waste to the forests, it is because they really can. Thank you very much.
From the Rebecca Cohn Auditorium in Halifax, you've been listening to Peoples of the Anaconda, the third of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures by Wade Davis. The book of the 2009 Massey Lectures is published by House of Anansi Press and is available across Canada. You can purchase The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, either as a book or CD, by going to the IDEAS website, cbc.ca/ideas. Tonight's lecture was recorded in Halifax by Mary Link with recording engineer Pat Markle. The 2009 CBC Massey Lectures were produced for IDEAS by Philip Coulter. The CBC Massey Lectures are co-sponsored by CBC Radio, the House of Anansi Press, and Massey College in the University of Toronto. The executive producer of IDEAS is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.